Hello and welcome to Upvote, a tech and politics podcast from Wired UK. I'm Roland Manthorpe, Associate Editor of Wired, and today we're talking about artificial intelligence. Not so much the technology, but rather the policy of AI, which is a subject of great fascination in government at the moment, as you could see very clearly in last week's budget, where the headline was basically that we're not growing and we're not going to, and we don't have any money as long as you're not going to borrow, but what money that he did have to spend, the Chancellor used to make some very interesting commitments to this new technology of AI, which I really just goes to show how central it is to current thinking about technology. I mean, in policy terms, it's being treated almost like the internet was 20 years ago. Whether that's because it sounds cool or because it really is like the internet is another question. I mean, personally, I find it quite strange to hear Philip Hammond predict that we will definitely have driverless cars on Britain's roads by 2021, which, I mean, I would put at the more bullish end of predictions on this, even by industry hype standards. But anyway, so the plan for AI specifically, this is, you know, rather than driverless cars, is to invest at least $75 million into it, to build data trusts to help train and run AI systems, to establish AI fellowships, and to give grants to fund 450 PhDs in the field to secure the UK's leading position in the global AI market, whatever that means. And all of these recommendations came pretty much directly from a big independent report commissioned by the government, which was released at the end of last month. It was called Growing the Artificial Intelligence Industry in the UK. And the other week, its co-author Jérôme Pezenti came in to tell me about it, as did Stephen Cave, Executive Director of the Leverhulme Centre for the Future of Intelligence, who's one of my favourite thinkers in this area. And he had literally, on the day we spoke, had literally just come from Whitehall, where he was meeting with civil servants about this very issue. But this was before the budget, so we didn't mention that specifically, but the conversation touched on all the things that the budget eventually included. And it was really interesting to discuss with Jérôme, especially, the detail of what he recommended, especially this question of data trusts, which I think is a really clever, innovative approach that tackles a lot of the more complex questions about ethics and logistics that you get when you start dealing with the kind of data that artificial intelligence needs to function. But first, I began by asking Jérôme, who's French and based in the US, how he got involved in a report for the UK government.
Well, actually, my company, Benevolent AI, is actually UK-based. It was founded in London, and so we have a big presence here. And you're right, I'm actually French, I'm based in the US, I'm expanding the company there, but I'm very much present here in the UK, and we're one of the big players here. So I was asked by a government official to participate in the report.
And what was it like to do? Because, I mean, I know this is your first report of this kind. What was the experience like?
It was rather good, but I think we set up some own parameters for it. For me to join was the idea to create something that was very pragmatic. Rather than doing a report that will last a couple of years, we decided to do it in a very short time frame, and we had good support from civil servants.
And so there are 18 recommendations, and we're going to discuss a little bit about them. But first, I'm wondering, I mean, how's it been received by the government? I hear you were mentioned by the Prime Minister the other day.
That's right. So I think the government did a okay job initially to promote it. But little by little, we got a lot of interest from many people, including you today. So it's actually the word is coming out. And I think government is serious about implementing what we are recommending. That was one of the things I brought. You know, I come from the industry background, so I wanted to do a report that as soon as it's done, we look at implementing it.
Stephen, these reports, they come out periodically. And from the outside, it's often hard to tell what they mean. Sometimes they arrive with a great fanfare and then nothing happens. Sometimes there isn't a great fanfare, but lots seem to happen. I mean, what's the difference between one and the other?
It's all about the right thing at the right time. And the government is a very slow-moving beast. And if government isn't ready to hear a particular message, then the report will end up on a shelf. But I think in this case, the government was aware that AI is the current big thing, that it needs to do more and think more deeply. And I think wisely, instead of looking only in-house for that expertise, the government commissioned Jérôme and Wendy Hall to do this report. And because the government wanted it done, they were ready to listen. And so I think this is a report that really can make a difference.
And from it,
I mean, you've seen it. What kind of stuck out to you from the report?
Well, as Jerome says, it's very practical. Of course, there are lots of really big issues about AI and imagining the future with intelligent machines that the report doesn't address. And Jerome mentioned that they clearly set a limited scope from the beginning in order to come up with some practical recommendations that could be implemented now. And I think that was very wise to be clear about what they wanted to do. But at the same time, there are a lot of other questions that we're going to need to think about.
So the recommendations fall into four broad areas. There's improving access of data, improving supply of skills, maximising research and supporting uptake of AI. I mean, Jerome, from those four, was there one that you think is really the most important?
I'd say there are really two that I'd like to highlight. You know, the first one is around access to data. And we come up with a concept of data trust, which is a way to facilitate the sharing of data. The second is around skills. And the funny thing about AI is it you'd think it's all about machines, but actually AI today, the challenge is all around getting humans able to create good AI. Okay, I think actually the UK is pretty well positioned right now, but it's a race, you know, it's a big race where you have obviously the US and China, and then you have Canada, and you have all the continental Europe countries as well, right? So it's really important that, you know, the UK be at the top of the race. And that means, you know, grooming the best talent here and attracting the best talent.
Because, Stephen, that's kind of the context for all this, right? That the world's countries are thinking that AI is the next big technology, and that if they want to be able to compete, they have to be involved.
Yes, that's right. And we in the UK, as Jerome says, have an extremely strong base from which to start. We've got really great research institutions. There was a report published in the Financial Times just the other day showing the top 100 institutions for citations, and a huge number of UK universities were there. So we've got a really strong base on which to build. But of course, other countries are really waking up to the importance of this technology and investing billions and billions into skills. Now, yes, we have to keep up, but at the same time, I don't think we should see this too much as a race. This isn't a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing a lot of trade with these companies. We're investing in China. China's investing here. So yes, we have to keep up to really maximize how we can use this technology, but at the same time, we'll be working with all these other countries and benefiting from their investment.
And so one of the recommendations, just to highlight one as an example, is that we could have a new master's in AI machine learning, and that might be sponsored by companies.
Actually, we don't recommend a new master. We recommend that some masters that exist today add some new position that would be funded by industry. So what we found, I mean, I'm part of industry, and the challenge today is to get people with skills, okay? And it's a very, very tight market, and it's a very high demand. And so the industry players are ready to actually step up and pay for masters for students, you know, in the UK. And there's a huge interest from them to be able to finance master so that you get more students out there, and it relieves a little bit the pressure on the demand.
I mean, so when government has made these pushes before, sometimes by the time the people have come through, this hasn't been the skill that's been needed.
That's a good point. You know,
Did you think about that when you were looking at these recommendations?
Yeah, we did. This way, also, we started with the master as some practical thing we can do today, because we could. I mean, the goal is to set up the master, you know, program this year and start financing them next year. So you can go very quickly, and then you have the skills. You're talking about 18 months, but we do believe, okay, that AI is here to stay. Okay, it's going to be around in 5 years, in 10 years. You know, it's like think of the internet in 1996 or 1997, not going to disappear. So these skills actually are there for the long term. So we are also recommending to look at PhDs, to look at fellowships, to go beyond just the 2 years of a master.
And actually, so I didn't define AI at the beginning, but I suppose I should ask, when you say AI, what do you mean? Because I'm sure that it's conjuring up images in maybe some people's listening heads of, you know, scary robots wandering the streets. But I don't think that's quite what you're talking about.
No, okay. I think you should ask Stephen to define it. Yeah, I'm sure he's a much better.
Well, Stephen's a philosopher, so exactly. Definition is his game.
Yeah, but avoiding giving definitions is also our game. So there is no good definition of AI. You could say it's getting computers to do clever things. Sometimes people say it's getting computers to do things that would ordinarily require human intelligence. Well, that's not a bad starting place, but actually my calculator does maths that would ordinarily require human intelligence. We don't think it's very intelligent. And visual processing, for example, or natural language processing. These are things that actually, or particularly visual processing, that, you know, very simple organisms can do, but in computers require great sophistication. So there isn't a very clear mapping of machine intelligence onto biological intelligence. So really we're just talking about doing sort of fancy, impressive, useful things with computers.
But the big change in the past 5 to 10 years is that AI is very much centered around machine learning. Okay, so it's the other key term that people should be aware of. And the idea with machine learning is that you give the machine some data from which it will extrapolate a behavior. And that makes actually data critical into this new discussion around AI. It's really very much of a data-centric world where, you know, the algorithms are written by the data, if you want. And that's the big change.
And what kind of skills do you need to to operate this? We're talking maths PhDs essentially.
That's right. But actually, there is really a practice of AI that's different. When you write code to do machine learning, it's a different kind of coding that you would do for regular, you know, writing some Java code to do a regular process. So it's a different kind of thinking. That's why you need people. This is why these people are so thought after, to have a practice of how do you feed data from a machine to tell it what to do.
Okay. And Jerome, I have a question about one of the recommendations. I think what's really positive about the report is, in some ways, I suppose it does pick up some of the ethical issues and build them into the sort of industrial strategy aspect. And one of them is, which is both an ethical issue and, if you like, part of the vision of how to grow this technology, is about increasing diversity. Now, you know, here we are, three white blokes standing around this table talking about this, but I'd be really interested to hear, as you move into the implementation stage, how you think we can do that.
That's a very good question. I mean, as actually a business executive, that's something that I pay attention every day. I do believe in my business, diversity is a key driver. You know, I need to have people with different mindsets trying to solve the problem. Doing this also with Dame Winnie Hall, you know, she's a dame. She has been in the computer science world for a long time, being a woman. I mean, she has lived it for the past 20, 30 years. So it was big on our mind. I will tell you the challenge is to be able to work with the constraints. So one thing I brought in immediately is, you know, can we actually do what's called in the US, I don't remember the term, but, you know, basically favor certain demographics. And I was told, no, we can't do that in the UK. That's only a US thing, right? So, you know, what can you do in that context? So I think we had some ideas, you know, especially, for example, when you enlist people for the masters or the PhDs or the fellowship, you know, look at AI in a broad sense, you know, not just look at the narrow, oh, okay, I want just people who can create 10,000 lines of code a day. You know, there are many interesting aspects. For example, the bias aspect, you know, the bias aspect in machine learning is really a critical aspect. Everybody in that space will tell you that it's a real problem. But I think if you bring people who understand bias, they will have a much better chance to really actually address that problem. And if you look at the demographics of people who think about it and talk about it, usually they are much more diverse demographics. So I think if you have selection criteria that look at a broad vision, and you know that because you're, you know, doing an institute actually that tried to get a broad vision of AI, you will get a different kind of demographic. That's what we want. We want people with different point of views that go into AI, and we're trying to entice that. And I'll tell you, it's not easy because you have also constraints, right?
One other issue that's been in the news a bit recently is this notion of a brain drain, that AI, people studying AI, PhD students or even professors, are being picked up by the companies, the big companies, especially in the US, so quickly there isn't anyone to do the fundamental research. I wonder what you make of that in terms of a skills context.
That's absolutely a problem. Okay, if I will tell you how much new PhDs make, let's say, you know, in the US or in the UK out of that field, you know, you will basically, you know, go back to school immediately. Okay, it is insane.
Tell me, I'm interested.
So a new PhD, you know, in New York, you know, right now, if you're in that field, can make more than $200,000 a year.
Wow.
Straight out of the PhD.
That's a lot compared to the alternative, which is the academic salary.
Okay, so it is that's the problem. You know, there is a huge discrepancy right now. And you need to bridge that gap. This is why, for example, in the report, we suggest to have fellowships who are actually well-funded to bring these experts in, you know, because you need to keep experts in academia to train the next generation. So there is actually an issue right now, which is you cannot just drain everybody from academia. Who is going to train the next generation? So even for industry, it's important that it doesn't go down that path. But the challenge is everybody also look at hiring the best, right? So it doesn't necessarily naturally happen.
because Stephen, I know you were working with Zubin Garamani, professor of computer science at Cambridge, and then he went off to Uber. I mean, yeah, this is a real thing, isn't it? And I wonder if the fellowships model, sponsored by companies, I mean, could that cause potential conflict of interest problems? If a company wants to do one thing and then, you know, the research takes someone in a different direction.
Well, universities are used to managing exactly that problem. I mean, quite a lot of research is funded by industry one way or another, and so there are established sets of practices, codes of conduct in place to preserve academic integrity or to be very explicit about, well, whether we're solving a particular problem for a company here or doing fundamental research. So I don't think that's necessarily the problem. There will be other sort of difficult issues within university politics if we pay some professors or even some postdocs vastly more than others in, you know, English literature or studying Anglo-Saxon poetry or whatever, just because their market value is different. But that might be one of the directions we need to explore, because this is a huge problem and it's impacting at every level, not just the PhDs and postdocs, but senior professors. And you say industry is very much aware of the problem, but it's not in the interest of any individual company.
Exactly, that's the
problem. The problem.
But, you know, one of the suggestions we make is to facilitate this mixed model. I do believe that's where we're going to go, which is that you can have people in academia and the industry at the same time. Also, try to solve IP issues without having to involve, you know, a lot of legal fees around that as well. You know, find some template as to, you know, you can be in both. That's a natural position, and you know what your boundaries are, and you don't try to reinvent that every time. You know, every university right now is trying to figure it out, and what we are trying to suggest actually that there are templates out there that people can reuse, so that, you know, you can do it at scale.
And you just mentioned data. Data is kind of what makes all this possible, right? Gigantic amounts of
data. Absolutely.
And one of the really interesting recommendations in the report, you mentioned it already, is this idea of data trusts. Well, why don't you explain? What do you mean by data trusts?
Sure. Let me tell you the problem we're trying to solve and tell you what solution we're providing. Okay. The problem today is that the access to data is limited to the major players. So if you take the top, you know, US companies, not to name them, right?
Google.
They have a disproportionate... I'll let you name them, okay?
Uber.
They have a huge... they have access to a huge amount of data, and they are kind of the only one having access to that data. The other piece of data, for example, government has access to a huge amount of data, but there are very little incentives for government to share that with an ecosystem of, let's say, startup and promote, you know, innovation around it. So what we want to do is facilitate the exchange of data. And today the problem with exchanging data is it's very much a legal problem. You know, if I'm a government servant and I say, okay, I'm sure that this startup could be able to use that data to create new software, a new system that could help me be more efficient, you have to go through a lawyer to set up a data sharing agreement. And it may take months to do this, right? Because it's very tricky, it's a very difficult problem. So what we want to do is facilitate these templates so that people can share data, and especially government, very easily.
And because obviously DeepMind, I mean, maybe the kind of the leading AI company in the UK, got into a lot of trouble.
Absolutely.
In its data sharing agreement with the Royal Free Hospital. So is this, Stephen, the biggest problem that we face with AI?
It's certainly a big bottleneck, and there are a lot of tricky issues involved. And I think the data trust approach is such a clever one because it tackles a number of them at the same time. And it's just the right concept. It isn't a vault that we're talking about. It's actually a set of processes and relationships that really are about building trust. I, as someone who generates data, need to be able to trust the organizations using it that they're going to do so in a responsible way. Businesses need to be able to trust each other in the way they're exchanging data and security and what have you. And we need to be able to, those who are using that data need to trust the quality of that data. And this at the moment is an area that's far too under-regulated. And I think some of Jerome's proposals really go in the right direction.
Man, Stephen is just better at talking about it than I am.
So am I right in thinking that the key thing with this data trust is to decide who really owns data? I don't know if that's the right metaphor, but to basically create some kind of property rights around data so that it can be shared and moved around more easily? Is
so
that the general approach?
That's actually the long-term vision. The short-term vision is really much more mundane, if you want. It's about having people in government facilitate these kind of agreements, come up with templates, And once you actually come up with a template, it will be easier for people to tell when you give your data, okay, that data will go into a trust and it will have certain condition on how it can be used, okay? That's a long-term vision, but we also have a plan to implement it because we don't want government to have to legislate right now. That will make it too complicated. So we want the government to get started, put a set of people whose only goal in life is to allow the sharing of government data and facilitate it so that people don't have to pay big lawyer fees when they want to access government data. That's the first step. And then after, it's really this question of where you put the data, who owns it, and potentially down the line, a trust could own that data rather than a corporation or a company.
So who does own this data then? Because this is a kind of a knotty area, right? Because often it seems like the company owns, once the company's taken possession of it, it owns the data.
That's right.
And then at other times, it seems as if, well, the originator of the data owns the data. And I know this seems like a legal technicality, but this is actually really important in our understanding of what is going on in this new data economy.
That's right. And right now, this is a big problem you're mentioning. And I do believe that down the line, we will have a different conception of ownership of data. And I think the data trust could be a vehicle to do that. But today, we're not going to change that, which means that we say, okay, if government has your data today, you know, can they share it? So can they give access to other people? That's the key, you know. Sharing data so that multiple people can get insight out of that data, that's the key. If you have one person that owns it and it's into a vault, then it doesn't really benefit humanity when it's there, right?
Because benevolent AI... Oh, sorry, Stephen, you were about to say.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think we might need to move away from the idea of ownership with regard to data. I'm not sure it really makes sense. When you think about the way people interact in the normal, non-digital world, we're learning about each other every time we meet. You know, I'm hearing what you say, I'm looking at you. So in a sense, we're acquiring data about each other. And I don't think you do probably don't feel like you own my image of your nose that is now on my retina in any meaningful sense. So we're building our interactions around this kind of data that in a way we're freely exchanging. But of course, machine learning and digital technologies have completely transformed the way in which we can really gather this data and what we can do with it. But I think it's too late to move to some kind of ownership model. And instead, we have to be thinking about, well, what is fair usage? What is respectful usage? How do we maximize the public good with this data that's out there?
That's actually, you know, every study shows that if people knew what their data was used for, you know, they will be extremely willing to actually give it. You know, if you have a disease, for example, all the patients who have certain disease are extremely willing to give their data to facilitate finding a treatment. I mean, I think you would find like 99.99% of the patient wanting to do that. But the problem is often, you know, people give their data and they don't know where it goes and they don't know what it's used for. Is it used to sell them more, you know, raw goods or some stuff? Or is it used for the good of humanity?
So let's talk a little bit about the potential of this stuff then. I mean, Stephen, in a broad sense, is AI going to... Well, the question in my mind, this might be too big, is AI going to help or hinder us in the future?
Well, that depends on us, I think. I think we have to move away from the language of technological determinism. This isn't happening to us. You know, we as a society are generating this technology, and I think we need to start talking about, well, if this, then what? How do we want to use this technology? What is our vision of a world with intelligent machines? There's nothing inevitable about it going really well or very, very badly.
And because the main use of this technology at the moment seems to be to give us really, really personalised adverts.
let me disagree here, okay? My company uses AI to come up with new treatments. Nothing to do with ads. I think everybody will agree that it's actually a good outcome. And there are many other companies out there trying to really make things better, faster, improve the life of people using AI.
Although at the moment, I mean, so as we mentioned, the really big companies, the Google, Facebook and so on, this is like their primary use of all the data they possess seems to be really to try and sell us stuff.
No, that's not accurate. Actually, you know, let's pick one company. Okay, Facebook. You know, they use translation so that people can communicate across languages. They use transcription so that, you know, people who cannot hear can actually look at the video and understand what's being said. Right. So they're actually really putting AI to good use.
But at the same time,
you're being a little selective here, you know.
But at the same time, we have to take Roland's worry seriously, and I mean, they are legitimate. And in a way, AI enables us to get better at doing pretty much everything. And a huge amount of human activity in the last centuries has been spent trying to sell each other stuff. So AI can help us to get really good at that. And this goes back to the data point, where, you know, when Facebook or Google or some other company knows more about you than you do or has some huge amount of data about you, it can effectively press the right buttons to get you to buy whatever or as we say, as we have seen, act in a certain way, vote in a certain way. And
so that's where you get into, I mean, but at the end, we are the one pressing the button, right? Nobody is forcing us. And in many cases, having a more relevant ad is better than having an irrelevant ad. Okay, so let's not make it bigger than it is. Now, sometimes you wonder where that ad comes from and you wonder what data was used. And I think more transparency around the data that's being used and how it came there will be good for everybody.
Will this help us do good things with AI rather than sort of more negative things? Or is this just simply trying to actually widen the amount of things we can do?
You know, I think AI is a technology like any other, right? Which we, by essence, is neither good or bad. It depends on what you do with it. I do believe, though, that the community, coming more from a scientific background, is very eager to do something good with it, you know, and also is aware of the perception of AI could take over the world and replace humans. You know, not going to happen. I don't believe people mean well, but it's a technology like another, right? It can be used for the wrong things.
Because I guess it's, I feel like this is an incredibly powerful technology, and I have some distant dream that we would think really carefully about how we use it. But instead, because there's this kind of this race on between countries to be the best in AI, we seem to be powering full steam ahead, all in our separate channels. I mean, I don't know if this is a pure fantasy, or Stephen said you're sort of nodding at my fantasy. I don't know what it is. You know, just that we really think carefully before we do anything silly.
I think that's a really important point. And the sense of a race, the idea that we're in a race, is dangerous, I think, for exactly this reason, that it might make us think, well, let's leave aside all the ethical safeguards because otherwise we're just going to get left behind and we're going to lose the race. And I don't really think it is zero sum in that way. We do need to think about how we can use this technology responsibly and sustainably. And I would, in addition to Jerome's report, and you know, as Jerome's mentioned, this was really outside the scope of the report that he wrote. The government, I'm glad to say, and others also internationally, are thinking seriously about exactly what this means.
So, you know, in the report, we decided not to go down that path, not because we don't think it's important, but because we didn't want to address it halfway, right? There are really, really critical ethical problems around the use of data, around data biases that you need to address. I do think actually the UK can take a leadership role there as well. It's to find this kind of no-nonsense view of these problems and put something on the table, right, that allows to, you know, put it in the right direction while not impeding the, you know, the good usage of it. And I do believe there is a middle ground there that can be found. And the countries that will do that first can actually be the leader in that space.
And so, yeah, this seems to be what this report is part of a general movement towards, is this middle ground where we basically try and maximize the use of data and our ability to use it without getting into the darker areas as maybe they are, for example, in China.
Mm-hmm. Well, in China, they take a different view. I mean, it might look dark to us, but I recently was talking to a Chinese company who put cameras in every classroom and have face recognition technology so they know exactly what every single pupil is doing at every single moment of the day and when they're picking their nose and paying attention and when they're focused and they're not. And everybody, teachers and parents, are extremely excited about this and see only upsides about, you know, improving education and so forth.
I mean, from an AI company's point of view, that makes perfect sense.
Well, yeah, but not just the AI company's point of view. And I mean, this is what the AI company told me, so I have their word for it. But I mean, if that's a different value set in China, if privacy is less important and educational attainment more important, then it doesn't mean they're doing it unethically. They just have a different idea of how we balance these different values.
I suppose that one person's utter dystopian nightmare is another person's great idea for their child.
But I wouldn't worry too much about it. I know people are worried about China collecting a lot of data. There's lots of data here you can collect through means that are much less offending. And the key is to find that middle ground. And if you're a company, actually, in industry, I believe that clarity is what matters more than actually having some limits where they're not. You know, companies are very good at optimizing once they know the rules, right? And so I think it's important for the UK to be proactive about coming with a set of rules that you can act in. And I think, you know, the industry could flourish in there. It doesn't mean that there needs to be no rules or you can do whatever, or it's the Wild West. That's not actually what promotes a market, you know. I think having clarity around the boundaries of usage of data will actually help, you know, everybody.
Well, yeah, because property rights are the ultimate foundation of a market in that sense.
That's right.
That's a really important point, that it's not just civil society demanding doing this in an ethical way, but actually industry are increasingly saying, well, what does a responsible, sustainable vision of AI look like? Because we don't want a backlash. We want people to trust our technology. We want a sustainable business model that isn't going to be regulated out of existence in 10 years' time. So there's, I think, from all sides now, increasing willingness to sit around the same table and talk about, well, what is our vision for this?
And so what happens next with this report? I mean, you're in conversation with government about implementing it.
I mean, what made me feel good is, I think 3 days after the report came out, we actually had a meeting with ministers to have a plan for implementation. So we're looking right now at implementing many of the steps that we suggested. And I'm hoping that actually in the next 12 to 18 months, a majority of the recommendation will be starting to be implemented. I mean, I think what will come out is, opportunity for education. So we're looking at PhD position that will be created in the next year, master's position that will be actually funded. So I think what's great is that you'll have a lot of UK students that will get their master's paid for by industry. And this process of creating some data trust that will actually allow people to share data, you know, very quickly. So these things will happen in the next 12 months.
And would you take on another report if in a few years' time the government said, right, time for Act 2?
Let's see how this one comes out. You know, I want to see real action out of it. If that comes out, maybe I'll do another one, yes.
Okay, great. Well, Jerome, thank you so much for coming in. Stephen, really great to see you. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another Upvote. In the meantime, that's all from us. Goodbye.